The Science Show on RN. Well, as you heard, Donald Trump announced that America will return to the moon in 2024. Lots to do in just 4 years, but why bother? Oliver Morton writes for the other impeccably accurate magazine, especially good at science, The Economist. He's also just finished a book about the moon, one in which he refers to the orphans of Apollo.
Ah, the orphans of Apollo. It's a phrase that I first heard from guys around my age in America, so people in their mid-50s who remembered as children having seen the moonshots launch, and they'd sort of assumed that it was all going to go on, and you know, they were going to go to the moon, and everyone was going to go to the moon, and there were going to be holidays on Mars and all that, and probably jetpacks were involved too. And then but sometime around the 70s and 80s, they realized it just wasn't happening. I have this very complicated relationship. In some ways, they feel very entitled. They're saying, I should have spaceships. And why should they have spaceships? Most people don't have spaceships. At the same time, I can really sympathize with this sense that there was a future that they thought they were embarked on that just didn't seem to happen. And what's interesting now is that some of those people are now very wealthy and have control over large technological resources and billions of dollars, and they're doing something about it.
We'll come to them a little later, but first of all, I want to ask you Goldilocks questions, because it is said, of course, many times that the moon made it possible for us to be here, not just us, but most of the living things on Earth, because, say, the tides were big enough to shake things up a bit and create what eventually became soils, and which had pools of water in which there was variety and so on. But in what ways has the moon, because of its size, kind of stabilised the Earth and its orbit and its angle?
That's a tricky one. It's true that if the Earth had its current rotational period, if it had a rotational period of 24 hours, it would be unstable and its poles would flip and flop around as the poles of Mars do, and this would be quite unpleasant for things trying to evolve into mangrove groves and crustaceans and all the other interesting things that things evolve to on the Earth. The moon stops it from doing that. The moon very much damps down the range of things that the Earth can do. However, it's not clear if the moon didn't exist that the Earth would be rotating at the rate it is. It might be rotating much quicker. I mean, the moon is always seen in terms of what does it mean for us? What's it done for us recently? One of the only ways we're going to really be able to answer that question is find some other planets like the Earth elsewhere and see how mooned they are. If you imagine a world without a moon and us on it, how difficult it would be to imagine the moon. This strange big light in the sky. No one would invent a moon on such a planet. What are the things about other planets a bit like us that have something else that we can't imagine? What is as unimaginable to us about living on a world as the moon would be to someone living on a moonless world?
We also think of the moon as being, well, a great big sphere of basalt. And that's kind of it. But what you say in the book is that having been bombarded for so many billions of years and all those asteroids and other meteorites zapping it and even the wind from the sun accumulating. So what is there that could be precious?
There's nothing there that would be precious to you or me, but we live on the Earth and that gives us an awful lot of riches right around us. The thing that people who talk about exploiting the resource of the moon talk about mostly at the moment is volatiles, so methane and water and carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and things like that. When a comet, a big old gassy comet, hits the moon, it explodes. It gives the moon briefly an atmosphere that's more than the just completely negligible atmosphere it has most of the time. And some of that atmosphere freezes to the surface of the moon. Some of it just escapes. And some of that which freezes in these very special craters up at the poles of the moon where the sun never shines. The moon sits very upright in its orbit. And so at the poles, the sun seems to go around almost exactly on the horizon. Not quite, but almost. So if you've got a hole and one thing about being cratered is the moon is full of holes. You can find places in the depths of the holes where the sun never shines. So if something freezes there, it's going to stay there for hundreds of millions to billions of years. And there's pretty good evidence that in some of these perpetually dark craters at the poles, there are frozen ices. And that would be really handy if you wanted to build a moon base so you didn't have to bring all your water and oxygen up from the Earth. It's even possible that you might want to use them as fuel for rockets. At the same time, you might also, if you had your scientific hat on, and I think many people in moon bases will have a scientific hat, it'll be sort of like issued when they get there, you might think that this provides you with a wonderful sedimentary record of all the things that have happened to the moon for the last few billion years, and you might think that that sedimentary record was more interesting than turning it into rocket fuel. So that's potential conflict in times to come. But those are the resources that I think are most valuable on the moon, probably. There are other people who will tell you stories about there being special sorts of helium that you can use in fusion reactors. I personally think that that's very much a stretch. If people want to try, then they're welcome to try, and it makes some good science fiction novels. Ian McDonald has written a trilogy of science fiction novels about helium miners on the moon, and they're great yarns. But I don't actually think Ian really believes that helium-3 is going to be a big industry.
Well, there's a picture of the science coming back, the enthusiasm coming back, and also the resources and so on. And you mentioned some of the very wealthy people who are likely to be behind it and already have started. But in my reading of many books about astronomy, let alone the moon, I've rarely come across the description of one of these entrepreneurs as a little prick. How come?
To be fair, little is not used. I think it's a fairly straightforward observation that some of the things Elon Musk does are the things that a prick does. That he behaves in a very entitled way, insults people who are in a difficult position for fighting back. At the same time, I don't think there's anyone whose achievements in aerospace over the last 10 years I admire more than Elon Musk's. I mean, to build SpaceX out of nothing was an extraordinary achievement. My point in calling him a prick is not to offend or to titillate. It's to try and bear in mind quite clearly that there's a certain set of male techie attitudes that aren't necessarily the attitudes that are going to be best suited to allow you to pioneer new civilizations elsewhere.
Indeed. And you describe some of the enterprises, including ones of NASA. SLS, which you deplore as being a rejigging of something that won't work and costing squillions, as if many of the enterprises are, if not half-cocked, maybe a quarter-cocked.
You have to remember what things are really for. There's a fundamental level in which what the SLS is for is to allow the state of Alabama, where it's mostly made, and the good people of that state, to have a large facility that makes rockets. That doesn't mean it necessarily makes the rockets that make most sense for taking people to the moon. It just means that they make big rockets and that the senator of Alabama, who is a powerful man, likes that. It's very easy to sort of like mock the idea that space travel is political, but of course government space travel is political. And, you know, it was politics that created Apollo, which was cool for many people. It was politics that shut down Apollo. You can't have government space programs and not think that they will be done for reasons that go beyond gosh wow science or pure human achievement. That's one of the reasons it's interesting that there are now these private programs which have a wider range, though not necessarily a nobler range, of interests.
What do you think should happen next if Oliver Morton were running the show?
If Oliver Morton was running the show, it must be said, going to the moon would not be top of the list of things he was going to do. He would be looking at doing various things about climate and other issues here on Earth. That said, I think it would be very interesting to have a look at the poles of the moon. In an unconstrained world, one in which, you know, you're not sort of like robbing Peter to pay Paul, the opportunity for people to go to the moon and look back on the Earth would be a life-enriching and expanding one. And I'd like to see people have the opportunity to do it. There's a book by Roger Penrose and Brian Aldiss called White Mars, in which, if I remember correctly, everyone on Earth gets to go to Mars once for their honeymoon, but that's it. Of course, you know, you can't take 7 billion people to the moon. I wouldn't mind a lunar lottery. so some people could go up and sit. I don't really believe in it. People sometimes talk about it as a new continent because its area is roughly the area of a large continent. It's a bit smaller than Asia, a bit bigger than Africa. It's not really a continent in the sense that people are going to go there and settle it, partly because, of course, most of the continents on Earth other than Antarctica were already settled when people started telling stories about settling them. Space isn't like that. But it's also just not so useful. It's not so rich. I don't think it's going to be a new world in that slightly tendentious sense.
But surely it's the only one we've got, because frankly, going to Mars looks more and more unlikely. It's just too bloody difficult.
Yeah, no, Mars is definitely difficult. But the fact that it's the only one we've got, going to the moon isn't really an interesting thing in the same way as going to France is. You don't have a culture, you don't have the richness, you have a lot of grey rock that's very hard to get to, and it's endlessly trying to kill you. And that's normally not true in France.
Two final questions. But I remember when Sir Patrick Moore was on television, before he was Sir Patrick, and he was live on air, and he got the first pictures of the backside of the moon. I think it was photographed by the Russians. And there it was in front of him, and he was so completely nuts about the moon that he burst into tears live on air. There's no mention of Patrick Moore in your entire book.
I'm sorry, there are a number of people who are not mentioned in my book. I must say, I don't think I actually knew that story about him breaking down in tears. The story is really quite interesting, which is that the Russians did take the first pictures of the far side of the moon, but British radio astronomers managed to get the images back just as quickly. And if I remember correctly, they requisitioned the fax machine, then a very strange, odd object, from the Manchester offices of the Daily Express to Jodrell Bank to produce the images, which the Daily Express then ran, and those must have been what Patrick Moore would have seen. So there was some nice cosmic one-upmanship. There's another lovely story I came across writing the book, that the Russians were at one point using the moon to test some of their most advanced radars. And some Americans got wind of this and started using radio telescopes looking at the moon to learn about Russian radars rather than the moon. The only difficulty of which was that Russian radars turned out to work on exactly the same frequencies as the cab companies in Silicon Valley. And so they had to filter out people calling for their cabs. Obviously now it'd be much more simple because there'd be Uber and you could just look at the moon in peace.
And finally, they told you before you actually saw it that a launch would change your life in certain ways. Did it?
It did to some extent, yes. I think seeing a Saturn V launch must have been quite the most remarkable thing. There was a ship that watched the last Apollo mission to launch. Apollo 17 was the only one to launch at night. And there was a ship full of science fiction writers and others offshore at Canaveral that watched it. I think that would be quite extraordinary. What I saw was not as extraordinary as that. I saw what's now a rather routine Falcon 9 launch. And there's a certain beauty to it, but I think, frankly, the landing was more striking. And I think everyone suddenly got a sense of slightly what I'd seen that night when the first Falcon Heavy took off. And it wasn't so much the sight of the Falcon Heavy going up with its 27 engines, and it wasn't so much, though it was kind of cool, the shots of Elon Musk's red sports car heading off into infinity, but the sight of two booster rockets landing close by each other and within a second of each other with such precision and such power and such grace, that's really an extraordinary thing to see.
Oliver Morton's brilliant book is called simply The Moon. He's a senior writer of The Economist magazine. The Science Show on RN, where the rest of the programme is about chemistry.